Hi, everyone, and welcome to our podcast, From Pathogen to Infectious Disease Diagnosis, where we bring the connection between the laboratory and the clinic together to discuss how the latest generation of testing can really help us identify pathogens and hopefully get a diagnosis and harnessing potential partnerships between the laboratory and infectious disease providers. In our latest From Pathogen to Infectious Disease Diagnosis podcast, we are super excited to welcome Dr. Lau Su Allen Blitz. He is a physician scientist and assistant clinical professor of medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA, board certified in internal medicine and pediatrics. His work focuses on infectious diseases, global health equity, sexual and reproductive health, and the development of innovative diagnostics, particularly for sexually transmitted infections. His research and clinical collaborations have spanned multiple countries with an emphasis on improving access to effective, equitable, and evidence-based healthcare. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
You bet. So we'll just jump right into this. This is a really, I think, important early question to kind of help set the stage and the context for our audience. Can you provide an overview of some of the current challenges surrounding drug-resistant gonorrhea?
Absolutely. This may not be something many people are aware of, but gonorrhea has more or less systematically developed resistance to every antibiotic that we've used in its treatment over the past, several decades.
Right.
In the early 2000s, we used a pill, ciprofloxacin. It was a one-time oral medication and it worked very well. But after a few years of using that for every case of gonorrhea, the rates of resistance began to rise pretty steeply. And once the prevalence of resistance to ciprofloxacin reached 5%, our sort of best modeling and best mathematical approach estimated that that was the time when we should stop using ciprofloxacin and start using ceftriaxone, which is what we've used since then. However, we are now seeing a prevalence of ceftriaxone resistance in some regions of the world, not in the United States yet, that is exceeding 25%.
Wow.
And so we're facing a more or less a crisis of how to treat gonorrhea effectively and prevent the downstream consequences, right, which include an increased risk for the acquisition of HIV, pelvic inflammatory disease among women, infertility, neonatal blindness, and extreme costs to the health system. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars over the lifetime of individuals who have been infected.
Wow. We know AMR is a global problem, but when you start zeroing in on some of these particular pathogens, that's alarming, actually, when you start thinking about that. Can you provide an overview of a resistance-guided approach to treatment for this type of bacterial infection?
Absolutely. Resistance-guided therapy is predicated on the idea that, well, we can't use ciprofloxacin, empirically. Most strains of Neisseria gonorrhoeae that are circulating in the United States still are susceptible to ciprofloxacin. So if we were to rapidly predict the strain phenotype, whether or not it could be susceptible or resistant to ciprofloxacin, we could then actually spare ceftriaxone amongst the majority of cases. And our best data from the United States is taken from cultures, gonorrhea cultures at various clinics around the country. And about 60%, we think, about 60% of Neisseria gonorrhea strains in the United States remain susceptible to ciprofloxacin.
I mean, it really does kind of show you too, from a laboratory side, from where I sit, it really shows you the incredible value of an accurate laboratory test to determine those phenotypes, right?
Absolutely.
In a previous conversation with Contagion, you mentioned using rapid molecular testing to predict resistance and bring back antibiotics we've moved away from. Can you talk a little bit about when clinicians should reconsider ciprofloxacin for treatment of gonorrhea?
This is becoming more and more common across many realms of medicine at this day and age, this sort of targeted or resistance-guided therapy approach. It's now standard of care for Helicobacter pylori is to figure out the genotype before you start treating with an antibiotic. And it's, we do it for MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. And so, through genomics and genomic epidemiology, we have identified a single mutation in codon 91 of the gyrase A gene in gonorrhea that is 98% sensitive and 98% specific for predicting ciprofloxacin resistance. So rapid molecular assays that target this location and have been developed and are now commercially available in the United States and elsewhere. And they allow clinicians, within a number of hours up to a day to determine the gonorrhea genotype. And what's important to remember is that when a patient comes in with symptoms, they need to be treated then and there, right? They need to be treated at the point of care. But by and large, we think more than half, maybe 60% of infections are asymptomatic, gonorrhea, Neisseria gonorrhea infections. And so for most people, you have some time where you take their swab, or you take their urine sample, you send it to the laboratory, and you may not get the results back for a day. And if you can reflex the positive results to a gyrase A genotyping assay, you can provide the gonorrhea results, positive or negative, with the gyrase A genotype results at the same time. And we've actually done that in a couple of different centers in the US.
Is that a pretty quick turnaround for that reflex test to kind of get that?
So it depends on the platform, but in general, we've seen it. When we introduced it back in 2017, we saw it, around 24 hours, we were able to get an additional 24 hours, we were able to get the genotype result. A recent study out of the University of Washington, I think, found that it added about 2.5 days to a result. But patients, by and large, were they surveyed patients, and by and large, they were still willing to wait that extra time to avoid a shot. And that's probably the most practical reason to consider resistance-guided therapy is that, yes, it's going to have some benefit towards the ecologic drivers towards drug resistance, but it's also, just much more practical and preferable for a patient to receive a pill rather than a shot. They don't have to come back to the clinic. You can send it to a patient's pharmacy. You can send it to their sex partner, right? We've done genomic studies to look at the discordance in resistance genotype between stable sex partners, and the discordance, meaning one partner is cipro resistance, one partner is cipro susceptible, is very, very low.
And so important. I know you, and I'm sure that the audience that knows about this, especially in this realm of patient population, it's really critical that you have that ability to kind of make that educational value there. Excellent. So if ciprofloxacin can be reintroduced for susceptible cases, does that change how you think about preserving the other antibiotics as a last line option, or does it just buy you some time before resistance patterns shift again?
It's a great question. And, I'd like to look at this resistance-guided therapy with ciprofloxacin as the beginning, not the end. It's not the final solution. And I think on an intuitive level, that makes sense. And then there's been some modeling studies that sort of agree with this. But, it can't just be one drug. And we've seen that over the last several decades of treating gonorrhea, is that we can't just use one treatment option and expect it to work forever. And I think, introducing one alternative is going to have the same consequences, where over time, we're going to continue to push, probably slower, but eventually push towards further ciprofloxacin resistance, right? And then this won't work. And, it's important to remember too that other regions of the world, in East Asia and other places, the prevalence of ciprofloxacin resistance and Neisseria gonorrhea is above 99%, right? So resistance-guided therapy with ciprofloxacin is not the solution in those areas. But I think that this is, in some ways, the archetype of treatment diversification, right? We can develop these resistance assays using the genotypes and the information we know from molecular genetics. And for other antimicrobial classes, we've identified a series of mutations in the PenA gene where, if they are absent, very reliably, we can predict cefixime susceptibility, so another oral cephalosporin antibiotic. There are other antibiotics, penicillin, There's a genetic basis for penicillin resistance. Doxycycline, there's a genetic basis for doxycycline resistance. And I think over time, the goal is to develop a panel of molecular diagnostics whereby you can predict phenotypic susceptibility and really tailor your treatments to the narrowest antibiotic spectrum that can effectively kill the bacteria.
Yeah, I mean, what a fantastic option if we get there. I mean, it's one of those things I've been playing around in the world of AMR for probably 2 decades now, and that's the ultimate device and platform is if you can have multiple ways to kind of steer and even in that interface with clinicians and laboratorians and the patient, how we can educate, in that area. So important. You mentioned globally. So given that most gonorrhea cases globally are still managed syndromically without that kind of diagnostic infrastructure, unfortunately, how realistic is it, do you think, to scale resistance-guided therapy to low-resource settings? We know this is difficult, but how do you think that rollout would need to look?
Yeah, it's important to remember that most low-resource settings do not have a test for gonorrhea, let alone the genetic basis of drug resistance, right? So we're still in a paradigm, the majority of cases of gonorrhea are only treated if symptomatic. And if they're treated, they're treated with multiple different antibiotics, right? So further driving the pressure towards drug resistance. And I'd say that if anything, it is more important to apply this pressure and develop these tests for the global settings rather than just, one setting. And we've seen this in the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen this in gonorrhea itself, but we are a, interconnected world. And the development of ceftriaxone resistance in one setting spreads to others, right? And we're seeing that happen almost in real time. We've seen importation of ceftriaxone-resistant cases of Neisseria gonorrhea in the U.S. From global settings. So I say that just to emphasize how important it is to do this, but to directly answer your question, it is hard. I think it ultimately is realistic because it's necessary. And it's the focus of my work and what our lab does is develop low-cost molecular diagnostic tests for the pathogen and drug resistance. And there are now many, many other labs doing the same thing. I've seen post the COVID-19 pandemic, a lot of investment and interest turned towards molecular gonorrhea chlamydia diagnostics. And so I'm seeing, many more point of care tests come about, some of which are starting to incorporate drug resistance markers. And I think that's fantastic, right? The more that people are in this space and investing in this space, the cheaper it's going to become, the more accessible it's going to become. And so I don't know the exact path forward, but I'm optimistic.
Yeah, it's such a challenge, when you think about those low resource settings, even in Latin America, right? We know that patients can walk in and bite any antibiotic, in many cases. So it's just such a challenge. But hopefully, and thank you for the work you're doing, because hopefully manufacturing and research and others will continue to think about that global picture, because we know it's an issue here in the US, but certainly that interconnectedness makes it, if you don't fix it everywhere, you're not fixing it anywhere. So it becomes a problem. You
That's right.
mentioned, and I actually dug into this a little bit because I wasn't this deep into the gonorrhea diagnostic area, but the GYRA codon 91 assay that you keep mentioning shows about a 98% cure rate for susceptible cases, but FDA clearance and insurance reimbursement are still pending. What do you think is holding up that process, if you have any insight into that? And what needs to happen for these tests to become part of the routine clinical practice?
It's been a long road for this, specific codon, this specific assay. The people that I know who have been working in the space, predate me, and they've been working for decades. But I think it's a really exciting time because we're starting to see, these walls start to come down. And there's still headwinds, and we're swimming upstream, but I think we're making progress. And we do, you mentioned it, but we do have some of the best data for this gyrase assay. When there is a wild type codon, meaning non-mutated, and we use ciprofloxacin, we've had three different clinical studies identify, either 100% or greater than 98% cure rates across all anatomic sites, which is really important for gonorrhea because especially in the pharynx, it's very hard to cure, even with ceftriaxone. And ciprofloxacin has great penetration into the pharynx. So we have great data. We have tests that are now, we have commercial tests in the United States. Roche and Hologic and others, they have their analyte-specific reagent tests. And so they're available. They can't market them yet. They haven't been FDA approved, but they're available. And there are tests that are available globally that are CE marked or TGA approved in other settings. And now there is a large trial that is ongoing for three devices that is intended to support FDA 510K applications. And that trial, I think, just concluded or is about to conclude. And so we're expecting the submissions to go in soon and hoping, for FDA approved devices early 2027.
Yeah,
So that I think is forthcoming. But then insurance reimbursement, I think, is, it's not the hot topic that everybody wants to talk about in gonorrhea or other things, but it's super important, right? Because
Yes,
even with an
yes.
FDA cleared device, laboratories don't get reimbursed
Right.
for these tests, and so it's hard to implement. So it's something that we've been working on, and it's a fantastic group of people, smartest people I know are working on this. And one exciting update is that we now have precedent in the sexual health space for a CPT code, a reimbursement code for it just got approved recently for Mycoplasma genitalium detection and detection of macrolide resistance using a molecular assay.
Fantastic.
So CPT just set CMS just set a reimbursement rate for that CPT code, and we're applying the same sort of logic to the gyrosine codon 91 assay.
Nice.
We don't have that code yet, so it's not in my hand, but once we have it in hand, I'm hoping that FDA cleared test, CPT code for reimbursement, commercially available assays, and high burden of need, we start to really move the needle.
Right on. Good luck with that. That's such a, for people that don't know, that's such a road, that's such a journey to go through that process. So I congratulate you on that. Let's hope it moves through quickly.
Thank you. It's not me, right? I'm a small cog in a much larger system.
Way bigger than that. So as we kind of get close here to wrapping things up, from a fundamental testing and diagnosis standpoint, can you talk about how rapid testing is helping change the treatment paradigm? Everybody wants that test quicker, and accuracy is always important to us, but any thoughts on that subject?
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of rapid testing for especially for STIs. It is hard to get back to clinic, for anybody, just to like empathize with what, how busy people are in their daily lives. But the people who are suffering from sexually transmitted diseases often face, extreme stigma or homophobia or structural barriers to being able to access care that, we might not really appreciate. And so asking them to come in to get tested, go home, and then try and make your way back for treatment after you've told them they have an infection is really hard. And so I'm a big fan of decentralizing diagnostics or making diagnostics at the point of care and available other places as well, especially if you can incorporate these oral therapeutics, right? It's hard if you have to have an injection, because then you really do need safe practices for like nursing and things like that, and cold chain storage. And so I think that these point of care diagnostics will change the paradigm. And even if you don't have the molecular diagnostic component or the molecular resistance component to that, right, just being able to tell someone they have gonorrhea, chlamydia, or something else at the point of care is huge. I also think that with these point of care diagnostics, not all, it's not totally synonymous, but point of care diagnostics can mean a sort of self-contained test that doesn't require a laboratory infrastructure. And that is really where I think a huge proportion of the benefit lies, is that these global settings that don't have robust laboratory infrastructure, don't have the trained personnel or the capacity yet to set that up, can start to introduce these field deployable assays. And we've done this in different settings. We've done this in Peru. We have a couple trials set up for other places in sub-Saharan Africa. But we see that these tests, they can be run very simply. They can translate results immediately. And you can, once you have a test that's, robust enough and you've demonstrated the validity and you have some regulation around the test, you can start to change how people are treated and identify those asymptomatic infections, narrow the therapy for, if it's gonorrhea, you treat just gonorrhea. If it's chlamydia, you treat just chlamydia, et cetera. And I think that will have an ecologic benefit to drug resistance overall. And I think that'll have a tremendous population benefit to the burden of the disease that's caused by these
Right.
infections.
Right. I mean, and again, I know most of our audience knows this, but it's worth restating. This is just part of the problem of the bigger global, really a slow burning pandemic of AMR. Most data, most predictive modeling is looking at if we don't get a hold on the bigger problem by 2050, I think one in three infections will be AMR. That's terrifying, right? I mean, because
Terrifying.
we're getting to the places where whether it's STIs or whether it's some type of a sepsis issue, and if it's an AMR process, you're really under the gun there with respect to mortality and other issues. So really, thank you. Do you have any other closing thoughts or anything that we didn't talk about that you would like to share with anyone?
I think we covered
Okay.
all the important stuff. I will just emphasize that, it's a super important space, and overall, the needle is moving, and I'm optimistic, and I think it's time now to push, right? Like, we're starting to see some of the regulatory barriers come down. We're starting
Right,
to
right.
see more innovation in the diagnostic space, more interconnectedness in the global setting. So now is the time to push as hard as we can, and I think I'm optimistic for where this road leads.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us. I mean, in closing, it really is an important thing to consider in the bigger picture as we talked about for AMR. And then personally, just when we think about the interaction between laboratory professionals, the clinicians, and how that rapid information is still patient significant. I mean, ultimately, we're saving lives and driving those infections down. So, thank you again for joining our podcast from in pathogen to infectious disease diagnosis. And until next time, we look forward to seeing everyone. Thank you again.